that in Shlishi of Parshas Kedoshim. So on the beginning of the third Aliyah of Parshas Kedoshim, so the Torah tells us, V'chisavo el ha'aretz, unatatem kol eitz meichel, v'alartem alaso, espirio shaloshonim yelachem areilim, lo ye'ochel, uv'shana ha'rivi yisiyah kol pirio kodesh yilum Hashem. So we have the din of Orla and Netar Avai, that the first 3 years, the fruit of the first 3 years is completely off limits. It's asur ba'achila, it's asur ba'hana. And the fourth year is Netar Revoy, and it's brought to Yerushalayim. So there's a lot to say about Arla. We won't be able to say everything that one could say about it. But one of the points, just in a general sense, where Moshe Feinstein has a very general observation, where he notes that it's a little bit hard to swallow, hard to not swallow, that here these 3 years of fruits we're told that we have to basically destroy. It kind of goes against our mentality. We have a mentality of altashkos, we don't want to waste food. And here are 3 years of fruits that aren't going to be used for anything. So he suggests that this is just kind of symbolic about Torah as a whole, that while we try to understand what the dinim are about, but that can't be our guiding principle. Our understanding can't be our guiding principle. Our first principle has to be that we're going to submit ourselves to the rules of the Torah, and then we'll try to figure it out. So that being said, so what is Pshat on Orlo? What exactly is it meant to convey? Well, just linguistically, Rav Hirsch has a whole discussion, Shem Shem Paul Hirsch, about the language of Orel and Orlo that you find in the Torah in general, that Orla and Orel refers to something which we are prevented from using. So, for example, Orel Sfasayim, Orel Lev, somebody, Moshe Rabbeinu, was not able to use his mouth so effectively. Orel Lev is cut off from his heart, etc., etc. So, the idea of a fruit, a tree, being Orla means that we're essentially held back from using it. Presumably, he doesn't spell out this implication, but the idea that we use the term for bismillah also. The idea that we use the term for bismillah also, that seems to indicate that we're saying that the whole person is essentially off limits. You know, the whole person is essentially prevented from the full Kedushas Yisrael, and therefore, RL comes to indicate that that's the issue there as well. So here the fruit is called Arla, the tree is called Arla, and it has that type of a connotation. So what exactly is the purpose of this din? What's the tam? So you have different views in the Rishonim. The Rambam writes in Mar Nevuchim, consistent with how he understands a lot of things, but also especially consistent with this Aliyah, where you find other dinim which seem to be of that type, that this was an Avodah Zarah issue. That this was a practice that the idolaters would plant trees, and then they thought they were doing some type of kishuf to make the trees grow more quickly so that they'd be able to use them for their idolatry. And then... That consideration is what they want to get us away from, what the Torah wants us to get away from. That they would try to accelerate the rate of growth of the plants so that they could quickly use them for avodah zarah, and the Torah doesn't want us to be involved in practice like that, so the Torah wants us to stay far away from it. The Ramban understands differently. The Ramban understands that the whole purpose is that the fruit of the first fruits, the first product of the tree, we want that to be Kodesh, we want that to be brought to Yerushalayim, like Netar Avai is. But the first 3 years, it's not going to be such quality fruit. It's going to be of an inferior quality. So therefore, since we want it both to be the first fruit to go to Yerushalayim and that to be a quality fruit, so we wait till the fourth year in order to do that, which is a pretty powerful statement about how the focus of everything is its role in Avodas Hashem, that we're going to be so committed to that we're going to allow all of the first 3 years of fruit to go to waste so that the first fruit that goes to Yerushalayim will be a superior quality. It's a point that Rabbi Tzalev Radinsky has in his Sefer Mishka B'Tzalel. He has a whole discussion about that, about, you see, that's why the Medrash connects this pasuk for some reason to the idea of Eitz Chaim Hilum Achazikim Ba, besides the connection of tree, but the idea that the supporters of Torah find the Torah to be a source of life. So it's not just a tree imagery, but it's the idea that somebody whose whole mentality is that the Torah is what he's here for, and that's the purpose of everything he does, so that's going to be a source of life for him. So that's ideas you find in the Rishonim, in the Ramban, in the Rambam, but the Chazal sound a little bit differently. Chazal seem to suggest that it's a theme of patience, a theme of teaching us how to wait. And that there's a medrash that connects this pasuk to the next pasuk, which talks about Lo Sochlu Al Adam, and in this context evokes the Dam of Nida, and the dam of the animal that has not yet fully bled out after it's been shechted. And the Medrash seems to connect the two, that just like you're able to wait for Orla, so too you should be able to wait in other areas of life. You shouldn't feel that you have to have every hana at every moment without being able to restrain yourself. And that's perhaps the message that the Orla is there to convey. Our friend Rabbi Simon Shlita in the Imre Baruch has a whole essay about this, about that specific prat, where he brings other indications. He talks about the Eitz Hadas, the idea that we have in Chazal that the Eitz Hadas would have been mutter by Shabbos, but Adam HaRishon couldn't wait till that. So that was the whole downfall of humanity. The idea that it's the key to success was supported by a famous psychological experiment that took place in Stanford about 40 years ago. There was a doctor named Walter Michel who performed experiments on little children 4 or 5 years old, and he gave them an opportunity to eat a marshmallow. But he said that if you wait a few minutes, then you'll be able to have 2 marshmallows. And then he videoed them. I think these videos are available. You can watch them. That the ones who were able to wait and get the greater reward of the 2 marshmallows, they tracked them through life. Everything else in life they were more successful at. The ones who couldn't wait and who just had to eat that first marshmallow, so they ended up having less success in life. So perhaps that's the whole message of the Orla, that we're supposed to be taught to be able to wait, that we're supposed to be able to learn this need of patience. But the Torah first talks about Kisavo ala Aretz and emphasizes this idea of entering into Eretz Yisrael, which is not so clear why that is, because some of the Svarim explain, it doesn't mean Davka when you're in Eretz Yisrael, it means that this only starts once you enter Eretz Yisrael, which is similar to an idea we had a few weeks ago. We talked about Arvus, that the idea, I think in the context of Chatei Kadesh Yizkei Chaverach, we talked about this, the idea that Arvus started only once the Jews entered into the land of Israel, but it doesn't only apply in Israel. So too Arla seems to have that rule, because there is a prohibition on Arla's Chutz La'aretz also. However, Arla's Chutz La'aretz, the Gemara says, that's Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai. So Arlas Eretz Yisrael, that's what's derived from this pasuk, and the prohibition of Arlas Chutz La'aretz, that's Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai, which is a very unusual structure. So as the Taz and others ask, so you can have a halacha, that's Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai, so fine, so then let it be Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai. Or if it's going to be in the pasuk, so let it be in the pasuk. But why would the pasuk specifically have a miyut? Kind of imply that it's only in Eretz Yisrael. And then Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai comes to contradict that miyut. It says, oh, but actually it's everywhere. So what exactly is that meant to accomplish? So the way the Taz understands is that this is to show you differences. That, for example, there's a halacha, which we'll come back to in a second, that the safek orlo b'chutz la'aretz is mutter. So that difference in halacha is indicated by the fact that that comes from a different stream. It comes from Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai as opposed to coming from the pasuk itself. So the Rashba asks against the Rambam, that the Rambam's position, that the rule of Safek Daraiso L'Chumra, that we maintain we have to be Machmir when the din is Minat Torah, so the Rambam maintains that that din itself is a din Darabanan. So the Rashba says this is a Raya against this, because if we need a Drasha to tell us that Safek Orla is Mutter, at least Orla Schutz La'aretz, so then doesn't that seem to indicate that's a Chiddush, that Safek normally is Asr? So as Naim Mutara points out here, as others point out, no, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's going on here. It's that this differentiation is telling us that the two concepts have different rules. And then the different rules could cut in either direction. Could mean could be the chiddush really is that suffix arlos eretz yisrael is lahachmir. Could be the suffix going in either direction. It's all an outgrowth of the idea that there is a distinction between the two. So this is a major discussion in general. For example, there is a machlokus in the Mishnah at the very beginning of Arla about what happens if you plant a tree that's meant for public use. Is that also subject to the halachas of Arla? So it's a machlokus over there. So the Rambam says that the Rambam paskins l'chumra that does apply, but he says that's only true in Eretz Yisrael, and in Chutz La'aretz it's mutter. So it doesn't say that in the Mishnah. So where exactly does he get that distinction from? So it could be that this distinction comes from the fact that the two categories are treated differently, that you have Orlos Chutz La'aretz and Orlos Eretz Yisrael. They seem to have different rules, and this is something that Reb Chaim Brisker talked about in his Chidushim in Ochos Machalos Asuris in Parakut Halacha Tesvav, where he notes that when we talk about Halacha Moshe Misinai, this is a major yesod that Reb Chaim Brisker has in this whole concept of Halacha Moshe Misinai, that there are two different types. There's the Halacha HaMechadeshes, there's a Halacha Moshe Misinai, a Sinaitic tradition that teaches us a whole new concept, and there is a Halacha HaMifareshes, or Misfareshes, that tells us the details of something. So how do you view this concept that Arlos Chutz La'aretz exists? Is that telling us a detail in Hilchos Arla, that the Torah tells us about Arla, and then there's a detail that's mechudesh through Halacha Moshe Misinai, that it applies in Chutz La'aretz as well? Or do you say, no, that it's a whole new concept, that there's one din of Arla in Eretz Yisrael, and that the Torah tells us about, and then Halacha Moshe Misinai, there's a different concept of Arlos Chutz La'aretz. So that could affect the question of whether you learn out one from the other, and whether the rule should be assumed to be the same. Should we say that essentially it's the same thing, just the Torah, the Halacha Moshe Misinai tells us there's also this Chutz La'aretz extension? Or do you say, no, that the Pasuk is not talking about Arlos Chutz La'aretz at all. It's only talking about Arlos Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, any drasha you have in the Pasuk is only going to apply to Arlos Eretz Yisrael. And Arlos Chutz La'aretz, that's a whole new concept, Halacha Moshe Misinai, which will have its own rules. Hi.
Is that similar to the question of Amir Lachim on Shabbos, if it's like defining the spirit of Shabbos, or it's its own thing?
You could draw a broad comparison. I mean, for the most part, Mir al-Akum is assumed to be a din d'rabbana, not a Halacha Moshe Misinai. Right. You're saying, in general, you know, whether Chazal took a similar approach when they made the drushes, or they... I mean, you can ask the question very broadly about a lot of things, I guess. You know, is it a whole new concept, or is it just an extension of what's there? So to that extent, it seems to be somewhat comparable. But in any event, so this has a number of implications. It could also be reflective of the fact that the Gemara also has a statement in Maseches Brachos, Nafmami Vav Mud Aleph. The Gemara has a statement that called Hamekel Ba'aretz, in the context of Arla, Halacha Kamosu B'chutz La'aretz. That if you have a machlokas when it comes to Arla, so we follow the lenient opinion regarding Arla's Chutz La'aretz. So the Tzlach and the Arsameach and others, they say that's Pshat in the Rambam's ruling here, that there's this general rule of Kula. And that's itself an interesting question, why it is that there is this general idea of Kula. That it could be, the Ran writes in his commentary to Kedushim, Daf Lamed Tes Amud Aleph, that this idea of being Mekel is based on the idea of Safek, that if you have a machlokas, maybe that generates a safek. And in general, when it comes to Arlos Chutz La'aretz, so there is a din that safek Arlos Chutz La'aretz is mutter. This is a point that Rav Shechter discusses in a number of his svarim, that there are certain areas of halacha where the whole halacha is only addressed to a vaday, and not because of any rules of safek d'oraisa or safek d'rabbanan, but that the halacha itself has a detail that it only addresses a vaday. So, for example, you find this in Mamzerus, that the Gemara says that a safek mamzer is mutter, at least ben HaTorah. That's a specific din by Mamzerus. You find it by Avelus also, that if somebody is dancing at a wedding with an Avel, and the person who's dancing with him knows that a relative passed away, and the Avel himself doesn't know, it's not mechuyah to tell him. The status of Avelus only applies with Yediyah, with knowledge. So you have certain such ideas where the halacha only addresses a vadai situation. So when it comes to arlos chutz la'aretz, it could be that you have such a category as well, that anything less than a vadai simply doesn't apply, and that could also explain if there's a machlokas, and maybe we'll always follow the makel opinion when there is a machlokas in this area. That's assuming that it's an actual safek, that some machlokas don't make it to the level of a safek. This is also something that Rav Shechter discusses in Bikvei Hatzon. So, for example, he says if the machlokas is two different versions of what somebody said. So, you know, sometimes we say, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, that two people are arguing, two gedolim of a certain stature are arguing. So you say each one has a status like Torah, each one Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. So sometimes there's a whole machlokas what that phrase means. So on one level, it could mean they're both right. They both have a certain legitimacy to them. But as Rav Shechter argues, that can only be true if it's a certain kind of machlokas. If, let's say, there's a simple machlokas in transmission, that somebody said something, and we just don't know what he said, and there's two different versions of what he said, they can't both be right. You can't say that it means they both have truth to them, if it's a simple question of transmission of the facts. So a machlokas like that, I said, may not rise to the level of a suffix where you'd say that it's automatically mutter. There are others who suggest that might also be true, also by a machlokas between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. So for example, if you're learning Daf Yomi, so Gemara recently said that at the beginning of Maseches Beitza, that Beis Shammai, B'makom Beis Hillel, Leino Mishnah, that sometimes the opinion of Beis Shammai is definitively defeated. So in a situation like that also, so we wouldn't say that it rises to the level of a suffix in order to enter into this status. The Tzlach, in his commentary to the Gemara over there in Brachas, and Daf Lamed Vav, also notes that if we assume that Kedusha Shniya lo kitshulas lavo, that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael is not in full force today, which is one of the major issues that will be relevant to any discussions of the Hetta Mechira and the Shemitah and the like in the upcoming year. But if we assume that Kedushas Eretz Yisrael is not in its full force today, so then the status of Arlos Eretz Yisrael is presumably like Arlos Chutz La'aretz, that presumably it's all been in Kedushas Eretz, and whatever distinction there is that Arlos Eretz Yisrael coming out of this pasuk is presumably tali on that, which is part of the whole chiddush of this halacha Moshe Mesinai, that normally all the agricultural mitzvot, so generally all Eretz Yisrael mitzvot, are all tali on Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, and this one is different. Halacha Moshe Mesinai is telling us something very significant, that here you have an agricultural mitzvah that seems to apply in Chutz La'aretz also, so it's on a whole different level. Hi.
So I don't want to get too far, but in terms of Elu Ve'elu, so how do we look at, let's say, Das Yachid in the Rishonim?
That's a big question. The Elu Ve'elu, first of all, I have to figure out what does Elu Ve'elu mean. Presumably, a Das Yachid is Elu Ve'elu. It is the whole discussion, what exactly is the significance of Elu Ve'elu. You know, does it mean that it has a status of Torah so that you're at least learning something? It's not, you know, Bittul Torah. Or does it mean that it has some kind of truth to it? Or does it mean something else? I think the question that you're asking right now is not so much what enters into this mysterious phrase of Elu Ve'elu, but you're asking in terms of Halacha L'maisa, when there's a machlokas, how do you factor in a Das Yachid? How much does it weigh? So that's a complicated question also in the area of Mamonis. It has one approach. Other areas it may have a different approach. Post can have different klalim, or what's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, what's not mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. What even is a Das Yachid? Just to give one example, again, relevant to the upcoming Shemitah year. So there's machlokas in general, whether Shemitah nowadays is Deraisa Derabbanan, and many posts can assume it's Derabbanan, the Hetter Mechira is contingent on that. But there is also a view as a Das Yachid that they throw in, that maybe some of the Rishonim, maybe one of the Rishonim, maybe more, hold that Shemitah B'zman HaZeh is not even the Rabbanim, that it's Amidus Chasidus. And that should allow more latitude for the Hetter Mechira. So then there's a whole machlokas, is that a Das Yachid? Is that one view really about that? Or maybe it's only about Shemitah's Kesafim? Or maybe the other way around, maybe there are other Rishonim who actually held like that. So there's a lot to figure out about what is a Das Yachid, what role does a Das Yachid play, what does it take to be a Das Yachid. So we have to figure out what question we want to know. We want to know how does it apply in Halacha, how does it rise to Elu Ve'elu. Presumably whatever Elu Ve'elu means, if a person is on the Madriga to be a part of the discussions, and the point that Rav Shechter emphasizes in Nefesh HaRav and elsewhere, that Elu Ve'elu is not automatic, it presumes at least a certain stature to the to the disputants, but presumably then, once you're on that madrega, there's not going to be a question of how many. The day of somebody who's a part of the discussion presumably is divrei elokim chayim, even if he doesn't have a lot of teammates on his side. He has a lot to figure out about that. Hi.
What does since we're talking about elu ve'elu?
Sure.
How do we understand elu ve'elu when it comes to agadah, for example, in the beginning of Gid, with Pilegish Begiva? So God accepts both opinions of what happened, even though.
Right. So that becomes a big question. Again, what does elu ve'elu first mean? So if elu ve'elu means both are true on some level, so then there might be limits to how that could be applied. If it mean, it could mean that, you know, the halacha has conflicting components to it, and therefore both of these opinions could theoretically reflect the truth of the Torah, but we have to be machriya, so we picked one, but the other one still reflects something true about the halacha, so it might mean that, but then there are... So then, the point is that then there will be limits to where it can be applied. So if you're talking about something that happened, you're talking about a maisa, so then presumably we're limited to how many versions there could be. Although, in real life, still three sides to every story, but there's probably still limits to how many sides it can accommodate. So the same way that even within a halachic machlokas, if the machlokas is basically about reporting, is about what did this individual say, so then maybe that might not be a case where you could say elu ve'elu, so then so too they might extend the same thing to agadah. On the other hand, if agadah is meant to be a hashkafic interpretation, so then maybe there could be room for more than one truth. Also goes to the question, is there a concept of psak in agadah hashkafah, which itself is a question, itself a whole discussion. Okay. So to continue into the next topic within the Aliyah, so the pasuk, and it goes on about just one more pasuk about the fruits. So Roshana Chamish is Tochlu Espirio, Lahosif Lachem Tivaso Ani Hashem Elokeichem. So then the Aliyah goes into another section, starting with Lo Sochlu Al Hadam, Lo Sinachishu Lo Oneinu. So there's a lot in that pasuk, a lot to say about that. So just to try to mention some of the ideas briefly. So first of all, losochul adam, to say there's a lot to say. There is a lot to say. There's at least five, just on the basic level, a lot to say, because there are at least five isurim to oraisa, and more to rabbanan, that are assumed to emerge from that pasuk. Chazal have a number of different drushes on that pasuk, and that makes it what's known as a lav shebeklalos. You have a prohibition in the Torah that contains many different prohibitions in one set of words. So that's called a lav shebeklalos, which is generally an exemption from makos. That one doesn't get malchus for violating a lav shebeklalos. Machlokas Rishonim, if you don't get malchus for any of them, or just for the additional ones, if you can figure out one is the primary and the others is less primary. But certainly the other ones is no malchus. We mentioned, we talked about lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, how it might be viewed that way. We saw that our two possibilities in lifnei iver might be either that it's just a general pasuk which has a lot of implications and applications, or maybe there are different isurim that all connect to the same pasuk. So here, in the case of lo sochlu al adam, there's quite a bit, just to mention a few of them. For example, the point that we said a few minutes ago, to connect to Orla, that the Gemara says that if you shecht an animal, even if the animal has been halachically shechted, but the blood has not yet fully left, so you can't eat that animal. Another application is that for a karban, you can't eat from the meat of a karban before the dam has been nizrak. Another application is that if somebody was executed by Bezdin, so there's no sudas havra, lo sochlu al hadam. A fourth application is that, it's a well-known one, that a Bezdin should not eat on the day that they execute someone, that they have to feel the Chomer Hadavar, and they have to fast on that day when they're imposing this punishment on someone. And the fifth interpretation is that it's an Azhara for the Ben Sorer Mora, that in Parshas Kiseitse, so we read about the halachas of what happens to a Ben Sorer Mora. But what did he violate? That he should get this punishment. So this is what he violated. He violated Leisochlu al Adam. And what's maybe a little bit more well known is really the Derabbanan application of this pasuk, the Gemara Maseches Brachos. It says one should not eat before davening, which has a couple of different aspects to it, but seems to also reflect this idea that the way the Gemara says it is lo sochu kodem shiyisbalu al dimchem. That first you have to establish yourself spiritually before establishing yourself physically. So therefore, take care of the spiritual need to acknowledge God before you get involved in eating. And we also understand it to mean not just about eating, but about activities in general. Ad kidei kach, that there is a Rashi in Maseches Brachos in the Pei Mibeis, the Rashi sounds like you shouldn't even learn Torah before davening. This is not the widely spread practice. Tosfos over there objects to this. Tosfos says, what about all the Daf Yomi Shir? They're going to fall apart. So, you know, it's, nobody would come. So that's clearly not the widespread meaning to do this. Tosfos notes the Gemara in the second paragraph of Brachos talks about Rav would say Shir, and he would interrupt for Kriya Shema when the time came and for davening.
Just said in the Haggadah.
Right, so that's also a question. When does this Isser start? So presumably it starts really only when there's manav. You know, if somebody's learning at 2 o'clock in the morning, we wouldn't say he's learning before davening, but so they have to figure out when exactly the Isser starts. But Rabbeinu Yonah suggests that maybe there's a distinction between public Talmud Torah and private Talmud Torah, that maybe just to explain Rashi, that maybe Rashi's view is that that was permitted in that case because it was public, but private learning you can't do before davening. I used to go to the NCSY regionals, so they used to have davening Shabbos morning, and for a few minutes before davening, they asked me to give a shiur before davening. So I would usually speak about the parsha a little bit, topics like this, and then whatever parsha was would say a little bit about this machlokus, about whether you could learn before davening, because it seemed like an appropriate subject to talk about for a pre-davening shiur. So this is the machlokus harishonim, is how we normally are make on this. Then the pasuk goes on to talk about nechesh and ma'one lo sunachshu v'lo sonenu. So these are huge topics. We'll just explain what they mean and say a little bit about them. They are repeated in parshas shoftim, where you have the whole gamut of magic and sorcery related prohibitions. But just to speak briefly, so nechesh is essentially superstition. I think in modern Hebrew they use it to mean to guess. If shalu l'nachesh, I couldn't guess. But the Torah uses it in a superstitious sense, that if somebody attributes things that go on in the world to false signs, you say that, okay, if a black cat walks past me, I'm going to have bad luck, and I'm not going to try to make a business deal today. So that's a violation of nechesh. But if it's rational, if it's based on something that connects, then that's not a prohibition. It's also generally not prohibited if it's not the only thing that you're basing it on. If you have a couple of different factors that you put in, and you're also concerned about some type of simen, so then the post can write, that's also not called nechesh. Nechesh means you have to completely depend upon an irrational indicator in order for it to be a violation of nechesh. So for example, there is a minig to get married in the first half of the month. It's called the B'milui HaLavana, that when the moon is getting bigger, it's considered to be a Siman Bracha. So some of the posts can talk about, there was a tshuva about this by Rabbi Yehuda Asad and a few others, that let's say somebody has already booked a wedding, and it's in the second half of the month, and then he finds out about this idea, and he wants to switch it to the first half of the month, but he's going to have to lose his deposit, and he's going to have to cancel the caterer, and he's going to have to get a different girl. This one's not interested in getting married in the first half of the month. He's going to have to do everything differently. So should he do that? So the general attitude is no, that this whole idea that there is such a sim, there is such a simen, that's only acceptable. You could have worried that that should be a violation of nechesh. So we permit it as a type of inspiration, as a simen bracha, but not as something that you depend on as absolutely definitive. So especially if somebody's going to go to such contortions to rearrange his life to make it happen, so then that's already indicative that it's not being taken as just a simen bracha, it's being taken as the real element that's going to make or break the success of the wedding. So that would be nechesh, that would be inappropriate to depend so heavily on it. Flipping a coin is probably not nechesh, because when somebody flips a coin, so he generally doesn't mean that, okay, if it's heads, it's a simon, I should do this, and if it's tails, it's a simon, I should do that. Basically means that he doesn't want to make a decision, so he wants to make it random. So, okay, we'll use a random way of making a decision. Sometimes it's because of fairness, because you're dealing with other people, and sometimes it's, hey, you just tell me, you don't want to make a decision, so you'll make it random. So if you acknowledge that it's random, and it's just a way to randomly make a choice, so that's also generally not considered to be a nechash issue. Losa Onein is essentially fortune-telling. If somebody tries to predict the future, again, based on nothing, so then that's considered to be this violation of Losa Onein. And the Gemara also connects this to Achiza Seinayim, somebody who's, we might translate in English to sleight of hand, or at least idiomatically translate to sleight of hand. Literally it translates to grabbing one's eyes, but it's essentially the same concept of sleight of hand. So that's where the whole discussion comes up. So what about modern day magicians? Can they have a magic act, or is that a violation of Ma'onin? So many assume, many modern day poskim talk about this, assume that it should be mutter, because the modern day magicians are not actually trying to fool anybody. They're not actually trying to give the impression that they are doing magic. And in fact, they call themselves illusionists. They put it in the name that it's an illusion. So David Copperfield, somebody who's doing a magic show today, he's not trying to convince you he has magical powers. He's trying to convince you that he's smarter than you, that he figured out a way to do this, that you can't figure out how it is. But if you really thought that he actually had mystical powers, so he'd be offended, because he's not trying to create that impression. He's trying to create the impression that he figured out how to do something that you can't figure out how he did it. So that's a mental game. It's not a magical game. So many were making on this. So some didn't like it. And the whole Chayadim was upset about this. Later, Poskim talked about it, about how to see it. Moshe Feinstein had a tshuva that was published in the Amma Torah Journal. It was a little bit open-ended. And how exactly to view this, that's a whole discussion. So Rav Hirsch notes in his commentary that one of the examples the Gemara has in Sanhedrin about Ma'onin is if somebody says that, oh, before the Shemitah year, like we are right now, immediately before the Shemitah year, that the wheat is very good and it's better that it should be uprooted rather than be harvested. So that's another example of Ma'onin. So Rav Hirsch comments based on that. He says that included in Ma'onin is if somebody tries to attribute mystical effects to keeping the halacha, that's also called Ma'onin. That even though the Torah, let's say again, this example of Shemitah says, God says, if you observe Shemitah, I'll give you a bracha and you'll have enough to last for 3 years. So okay, that's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's bracha. He's entitled to say that. But the assumption that there's some kind of mystical power, that if you do a mitzvah, it's going to bring about some kind of mystical force, memela, so that he thinks is also included in Ma'onin. That's what the Gemara is getting at. Hi.
Segulas are very popular nowadays.
It's a big discussion in Poskim, how exactly that's... That's how exactly that fits. It's interesting that, you know, this week, without getting into the details, but just not to say one way or another, but the whole shlussel challah practice we could discuss in light this week, or how it fits in. Maybe it does fit, it doesn't fit with that, but it's just interesting. It's not always Parshas Kedoshim, it's pretty rare. But the idea of Achrim Moses Shabbos HaGadol, I think, is not happening for another, it doesn't happen for another 21 years. It's rare, I don't know what it's a simon of, but it's something. But in any event, so Rav Hirsch also suggests that therefore Lo Sochu Al Adam and Ma'onin and Menachesh in the same pasuk, that says, well, he thinks the Tzad Hashav and all the different prohibitions of Lo Sochu Al Adam, and in the interest of time we won't go into it in great detail, but definitely you're encouraged to read it inside, see how he explains it. Now he thinks the Tzad Hashav and all the different prohibitions is that they all are basically about allowing the animalistic to rule over the human. They take away from the human instinct and they give priority to the animalistic instinct. And so he says, therefore, the hemshech is that a person who engages in that type of a prioritization will ultimately feel himself subject to forces of nature that he doesn't have any control over, and that's not in his hands. And that's also the mentality of Nechesh and the Ma'onin.
Just going back to the Nechesh point, it could be confusing, but in terms of basic things on unreasonable ways, so... Isn't there a famous, I think, Haram in terms of Hilchos Mezuzah about the Knessios, about the Midrashos, that there was a dream involved somehow?
So there's a lot of literature about dreams, and that's a very contentious topic. It is a little bit of a longer topic than we have time for today. Dreams you have in the Gemara and in the Rishonim and in the Achronim, a lot of conflicting attitudes, and how exactly to address where dreams fit in Psak Halacha, life decisions. There's a lot to say about I don't know if we'll have time for it today. Hi.
While we're talking about mezuzahs, it seems to come from the Gemara, the whole thing that mezuzahs provide protection, and it's not necessarily in the pasuk.
Well, but the Gemara, though, said...
Right, the Gemara seems to understand that they provide protection, so doesn't that seem more mystical?
I don't know if that's, you know, that clearly does come from a strong tradition of Chazal, so it's...
You're saying if it comes from
Chazal? Yeah, it certainly comes from a Tarsh Baal Peh perspective, so it's hard to say that that's something that's... although one can treat mezuzahs in a way that they become, you know, kind of mystical, amulet-like, and that's an issue. My father always tells me that he objects to call tefillin, in English they call them phylacteries. I think phylacteries, he knows how the language works, but that apparently the Greek root of phylacteries... something like good luck charms or something like that. So that I think it's an inappropriate translation. It's not how we relate to the mitzvahs. It's maybe how the Greeks translated it, but that's not how we're supposed to relate to it. Okay, there's a lot more in this Aliyah, and we only have a few minutes left, so just to quickly make note of some of the many, many other themes that you find. Kedoshim really is a machine gun of a parasha, just boom, boom, boom. So next pasuk. So you're not allowed to cut off your payas, you're not allowed to cut around the sides, and you're not allowed to cut the beard. So there is a difference between the two, that cutting the beard, so we assume that means you can't cut the beard with a razor, that's what the Gemara says. That other ways of cutting it are not necessarily prohibited, what's called misparayim, gets into the whole discussion of how modern-day electric razors fit in. That's the whole discussion which we won't have time for. But the general assumption most of the Rishonim have, from the Tosfos in the beginning of Masechet Shavuos and the Rashi in the third parak of Makkos, understand that when it comes to cutting the beard, so that's davka with a razor, like the Gemara says, but cutting off the payas, rounding off the head, that's based on the effect. So therefore, that doesn't matter how you do it. You can't cut the payas off with anything, and the beard, Yidavka, can't cut off with a razor. The Rambam is the minority view here. The Rambam holds in the Yichus of Avodah Zarah that even by the payas, the Isser is also dependent on how you do it, and that the only Isser to cut the payas is with a razor. So this may or may not be Miyashiv, the mystery, if it's real mystery, that, for example, when I was in first grade, so we used to have these notebooks that have picture of the Rambam on the cover. Remember these notebooks, these little machberises? So, who knows how grounded this picture is. It's not a digital photograph, to say the least. So, what exactly is the pedigree of this picture? But the picture, the Rambam doesn't seem to have payas. It goes right behind his ear. So, there are those who suggest, to be miyashiv of the picture, that the Shitas HaRambam is that you can cut off your payas with anything other than a razor, and therefore maybe that's why the Rambam's picture has him like that. Well, Shitaso, that there is a way to do it, but most of us assume that, most of Rishonim assume that the payas is not kli dependent, it's all effect dependent, and that the difference in what tool is being used, that's about the rest of the beard. Hi.
So I know generally it would obviously almost always only apply to a man. Mm-hmm. Let's say you had a woman who had such an issue, would it be us for her to do it?
No, so it's befeirish that it's not us or for women to for either of these things. That's Baal Tashkis and Baal Takif, both of them are not subject, these are really the two lavin. But normally the differences between Chiyuvim as far as men and women are in Mitzvah Saseh, and Mitzvah Saseh Shazman Grama, women are Pater, and in general, Mitzvah Lo Saseh, women are always Chayavos, with the exception of these two prohibitions in this pasuk of Baal Takif or Baal Tashkis, that there is no prohibition. Baal Tashkis is a little confusing that we only use it in casual language to refer to the isser of wasting things, but in this pasuk it refers to the isser of cutting off your beard, so that prohibition explicitly doesn't apply to women. There is a lot of discussion about why it is that by the payas it says lo sakifu, it has a double language, a plural language, and by the beard it says lo sashkis. So there's a lot of it. The Gemara has an interpretation of it, there's a lot written about it, but just in light of this particular point, so Rav Hirsch suggests that it reflects this machlokus, that if we assume that when it comes to the payas, it's all about it can't be cut off no matter what, well, when it comes to the beard, it's totally on what you're using. So therefore, there's a difference in terms of public perception. That when it comes to payas, the whole world will know whether or not you're observing the halacha because they can look at you and they can see. But when it comes to the beard, they won't necessarily know because one might not have a beard, but maybe it's going to be that it was cut off in some other fashion. So that's more of a private mitzvah. So that's addressed to the yachid, while the payas is addressed to the public. It's a different level of interpretation. Clearly, there are other issues with Jews and beards. In Chabad, they have a tradition that to shave a beard is a violation of Begadisha. They also, there are those who felt that it was Chukas Hagoyim, which is the theme of this whole Aliyah in a lot of the ways. The Chassam Sofer and others have a tshuva where he argues against that point and he says there's no Chukas Hagoyim in shaving, qua shaving. He says that this was something that Jews and non-Jews started doing at the same time and it's not a particularly non-Jewish idea, even though beards are often associated with Jews, but he didn't see it that way. And he writes in that tshuva that the Ramami Panu, who was a famous Makubal, that the Ramami Panu was completely clean-shaven. Then I saw once in a sefer, it was published later, they wrote the Haros on the tshuva Chassam Sofer, so somebody wrote that's not true. That's what the Chassam Sofer reported, that the Ramami Panu was completely clean-shaven and that there isn't any Chukas Hagoyim in not having a beard. So what exactly is the history of Jews and beards is a whole dissertation one can write, but this is one part of the puzzle. A number of reasons why a lot of Jews have beards. Hi.
Isn't it mashma from the Gemara's heather to use scissors or things like that, that it's not considered Chukas?
Sort of the question is then maybe Gemara is just talking about trimming. You know, maybe the whole idea.
Completely.
But those will argue that the whole point is that the scissors won't take off the beard as completely as the razor, and therefore maybe it's a trimmed beard. So the question is there anything wrong with being completely beardless? So that is a discussion. Is it an issue of Begadisha? Is it an issue of Chukas Hagoyim? So there's a literature about it. It's a lot to say. So this pasuk is one part of the puzzle. It's also clear that when it comes, let's try to say this very quickly. When it comes to these prohibitions, so the Gemara explains, so let's say cutting off the payas, that this prohibition applies to both parties. If you get a haircut unprofessionally, so the person who's cutting the hair and the person who's having his haircut, they're both subject to this prohibition. So that was a big discussion for Shabbos, just to mention very quickly. So does that mean that anyone who's being groomed, let's say it's the one grooming and the one, the groomer and the groomee, are both subject to an issur? Or would you say misayaya, like we talked about in the context of Shnayim Sha'asah? We had a lengthy discussion about that this semester. So if you allow your hair to be cut on Shabbos, if you allow your nails to be cut on Shabbos, so does that make you a part of the Maisa? Does that make you misayaya? So that's a discussion. It comes up halacha l'maisa because it was machlokis, the shach and the taz, that the minig is for women who go to the mikveh to cut their nails first. So the shaila is, let's say a woman shows up Friday night to the mikveh and the nails aren't cut. So do we give up on this minig? It's what the taz writes. So do you take the shach's view that no, she can have her nails cut by a miralach, or she can ask a non-Jew to cut the nails? So the issue is that if it's an issa d'oraisa to cut the nails, so then amir lakum should be a problem. So there's a whole discussion whether it is an issa d'oraisa or not, and the question also comes up, so is the issa d'oraisa being done by the kari also? So maybe it's not even going to help to say amir lakum because they're both doing it just like you find by here. So the Rishonim have different approaches to that because there's a Gemara in Beitza, recent Daf Yomi, which sounds like having medicine applied to your eyes on Shabbos is not going to be your action if you let non-Jew do it to you. So what about having your hair cut, having your payas cut, that the Gemara says in Makis that it is a problem? So some of the Rishonim, the Ritva talks about this, some answers are given that it's more of a misayaya to have your hair cut than it is to have your something applied to your eyes, because opening and closing your eyes is pretty much a natural act. While others assume that this whole din here is really a chiddush by Losakif, that the way the pasuk is conveyed is to say that the prohibition applies to the cutter and the cutti, but it's not a yesod b'cholot harakulot, that's always true. So the parallels in Hilchos Shabbos won't necessarily have the same rules. The Chibin Rav has a fascinating tshuva where he contrasts the two issues of shaving on Shabbos and shaving with a razor. He says, let's say a person is being conscripted into the Russian army, I believe it was, and they bring him in on Shabbos, and they insist that you have to cut your beard to be in the army. So you have a choice. Either you cut it yourself or we'll cut it for you. But if you cut it yourself, So then you have options. So then what they used to do in those days, they would use some type of a powder. It's a depilatory to make the hair disappear. So you could do that on your own. Or if they're going to make them do it, they're going to do it with a razor. So what's better, that you should do this malacha yourself, shave yourself with a non-razor, or so that you can do it with a non-razor, or that you should be a part of this desideraisa of having yourself shaved with a razor? So it's a complicated discussion. There's machlokas, others disagree with Shimon Rav. It's a whole back and forth. And one of those, the Sefer on the Malachas of Shabbos, big black one, it's a Kalamitas Malachas, I forgot what it's called.
The gray one?
No, the big black volumes. They're two or three Malachas per volume. It's a 10, 12 volume work. But whatever it is, so in the volume about Gozes, in the back, he's got a whole kuntras about this issue. There's a whole, the whole discussion. So, in any event, so that's the question. What was better? Is it better to cut off your own hair on Shabbos with this other method? Is that Nisa D'Raisa? Is it ever Nisa D'Raisa to shave on Shabbos? That's itself a whole Malach Shesrich L'Gufa question. And so, are the Shabbos violations worse than having somebody else do it to you with a razor? That was essentially the din. Okay, to try to move more quickly. So the next pasuk says, "Avisera l'nefesh lo sitnu b'vsarchem uksoves kaka lo sitnu b'chem ani Hashem." So this is the famous prohibition of tattoos. Very famous because of the belief that somebody who has a tattoo is excluded from a Jewish cemetery. So it's not clear where that comes from, except maybe just the idea of a general balavera and this being a very visible avera at the time of Kvura. But whether it's an issue for Kvura or not, it's certainly an explicit pasuk in Chumash that one is not allowed to have a tattoo. But the details are subject a little bit to discussion. That first of all, just in terms of translating the words, so ksovis kaka, so it's machlokas rishonim, which word means which. That the Gemara says you need both in order to be chayiv. Apparently, one of them means to cut into your skin in a way that this will last; it'll be permanent effect on the skin. And the other means the writing and the putting in the ink and the coloring that will define it. So which word means which? Ksovis is one, kaka is the other. So that's the machlokas rishonim. But it doesn't matter which one is which because, yes, you need both to be chayiv, but the way it comes out from the Shulchan Aruch with the Shach and your Adeya is that it doesn't matter what order you do it in. It could be theoretically two ways of doing it. You could write on the skin first and then cut into the skin so that it goes beneath, or you can make the cut first and fill it with ink. So if the order mattered, then it would make a difference which word means which. But it doesn't seem to be the order matters, so it doesn't seem to make a difference. And the Gemara says in Makkos and Daf Chaf Aleph that there's also theoretically in Issa D'Rabbanan, if somebody has a wound and he wants to put burnt ash wood on it, burnt wood of ashes of wood onto the wound in order to cover it up, that could be an Issa D'Rabbanan of looking like a tattoo. And then Rav Ashi is quoting the Gemara saying, no, it's not such a problem because a person has a wound, so people see he has a wound, so then they understand that that's what it's there for. So that's the whole discussion. Is there an Issa D'Rabbanan under some circumstances? Apparently there is. And this idea that it helps when it's there for another reason, that we see that you're doing it because of the wound. So that was a machlokas. Does that mean that only the Issa D'Rabbanan is helped by that? Or does that mean that even the Issa D'Raisa, if it's clear there's another reason, then that's also going to be helped? So this is a major discussion of ice that comes up a lot. In the earlier sources, it comes up in cases that we're not involved in anymore nowadays. For example, there's discussion about somebody tattooed an Eved so that they'd know who the Eved was. So would that be an Isser or not? So it seems like that's maybe an Isser D'Rabbanan because it's not for the same purpose. There's also a Gemara in Gittin of Chafim Edbeis which talks about giving a get written on an Eved. And there's a whole discussion. So the Beis Shmuel asks an Eved Ezer, so how are you going to do that? How are you going to have Edim on the get? If they're going to write the name on the Eved, they'll be Rishayim. They'll be doing an Aveira. They'll become Rishayim right away. And even if it's only a Ksiva without the cutting, so it'll be Nisa Drabbanan, so they'll be Rishayim Drabbanan. How are you going to do the whole thing? Maybe the Shokik. So there's a whole discussion. Is it Mutter if it's for a different purpose or not?
What if it's an Eved Kanani?
Still, are you allowed to do it? So that one of the suggestions that the Beis Shmuel has is that the Miri has this and given that maybe it's not usher to your Eved because he said otherwise this is shver. How do you do this? You know, it seems to be going to violate Nisa D'Raisa. So it's interesting. This is one of the rare contexts where you see we talked a little bit about Davrshenu Miskavein and Malachas Shnitzricha Legufa. So Davrshenu Miskavein is a Kol Torah Kula expression. Malachas Shnitzricha Legufa is really a Shabbos expression, but there is some discussion in the early Achronim about maybe this is like a Malachas Shnitzricha Legufa, that you're writing on the Eved, but not for the purpose of the Zara, which seems to be the intent. So does it make a difference? Is that the same Isser or not? So it's a whole discussion in general. Many poskim assume that the Isser is really when it's done for Avodah Zarah. So the question is, if it's not done for Avodah Zarah, how does it fit in? Is it a Siddur Rabbanan?
Just most is cases it, nowadays, it's a majority.
Maybe not. But it would seem to be that it's certainly at least a Siddur Rabbanan. So then that's a question, what's included in the Siddur Rabbanan, what's included in the Siddur Eisa. So there's a long tshuva about this in a contemporary sefer called the Palgei Mayim. Chaim Knievsky has a whole sefer about this, called Paschag and Haksav. There's a lot of halacha maisa and nekudas about it. But there's also a more recent shuv in Sefer Palgei Mayim, where he talks about the question of, say, somebody, if a woman wants to do eyeshadow or something like that in a way that's going to last for a long time. So is that an issue? Is that a prohibition of Marasayan? I'm a little disappointed that he doesn't discuss that that's literally Marasayan, how the eyes look. But there's an issue that it looks like a tattoo. So he's actually makel on this because of a couple of different studs, that it's not the shame of a desire and that it doesn't last forever. Lasting forever is a self of machlokas that most of the Rishonim assume it has to last forever in order for it to be a tattoo. The Nebuki Yosef has a lashon of Yamim Rabim, and it's going to last for a long time. But the majority of Rishonim have the idea that it's got to last forever. But that even if it doesn't last forever, so you could think it's a concern of Marasayan, but the things that people know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, that it's not going to, that there are temporary versions of, so then some of the contemporary Mechabrim assume that there is, that there isn't even a concern of Marasayan. And this issue of the makeup, if I'm not mistaken, so he writes there, the Palgei Mayim, that Chaim Knievsky was machmir on this point, but he thought that based on all the different studim that it's not the shame of Avodah Zarah, that it's not permanent, and that its purpose is self-evident, everyone can see what it's there for, so it's got that component of being muchach, that it's not even an issa d'rabbanan, that's a discussion. He also, just to mention in terms of a little bit of synergy here, so he says he thinks there's a machlokas in general about this, the whole notion of davar she'eino miskaven, that you're theoretically off the hook if something is unintentional. Does that only mean the action is unintentional, or does it also mean the effect is unintentional? So that's why here, if it's not for Avodah Zarah, so then maybe you could say that even though you're intending to make this mark, but the mark doesn't intend to have any Avodah Zarah intent, so is that called the davar she'eino miskaven? So just to give a little synergy, he thinks that this is a machlokas and hilchas Bishul. So we discussed that the Gemara in Beitza, which the Rambam says everyone's in violation of Bishul, different partners, the person who lights the fire, who brings the wood, etc., etc. Remember that? So Lach Mishnah asks, how come the Rambam doesn't say that if you light the fire for the Bishul, you're in violation of Mavir? So Lach Mishnah says, well, it must be that Mavir is only if you need the ashes. It's a positive, constructive purpose. So therefore, it's not Mavir, it's just Bishul. So the Mechassinach asked him, but no, it's only that you need the ashes, so it shouldn't be Makalpil. But here you're doing your cooking, that's the productive purpose, so that should be Chayiv. So he writes there, the Palgei Mayim, he thinks that this is also the Machlokes, it's a Davar She'eino Miskaven, only if you're not trying to do this act at all, or if you're trying to do this act, but you're not interested in the Totsah that it's associated with, that should also be a Davar She'eino Miskaven. So in any event, that's a big discussion, how exactly this fits in. He talks there about a couple other issues also. Is the Issa D'Oraisa only about letters? Does it apply also to pictures? This is also a Hilchos Shabbos issue. How does it parallel the Malacha of Kosev on Shabbos? There's a lot of synergy as far as that's concerned. Okay, still there's more Pesukim. Okay, so let's try to just quickly throw in a few more ideas here. So then the Pasuk says, Shabbos Asayi Tishmor, Yus Mikdosh Ayi Tiro, which as the Naam LaTorah points out, that these are two different ways we relate to Kedusha, time and place. So Shabbos is Kedusha and time, and the Mikdash is Kedusha and place. And neither of those are in our control nowadays. We have to just wait for them. The Meshech Chachma suggests the connection between the two is that you have to have more Yiras HaMikdash on Shabbos and Yontif because people are batel from Malacha, so they are open to all kinds of temptations because they're not consumed with their work, so therefore you need a higher degree of reverence in order to create proper behavior. And he says, again, just for purposes of synergy, so in terms of Hotzah, so the Gemara and Shabbos of Daf and Zayin says that there was a gzeira on the women walking out with Hashitim in the Rosh Hashanah. So he says the same idea, that it's a gzeira dafka, that the women shouldn't be too appealing on Shabbos in the Rosh Hashanah, because people are roaming around and they're not involved in malacha, and the Yetzirah is stronger. So that's a bigger idea, it's a bigger concern. Okay, still more. So let's see, we're still running out of time. So the next pasuk talks about pasuk lamed aleph, al tifnu el ha'ovos ve'el ha'yidonim. So here we have other magical phrases, ovos and yidonim. Al tivakshu l'tama v'hem, ani Hashem Elokeichem. We shouldn't be interested in them for the purposes of tumbas. The Mashal Chachma writes that it's mutter in order to paskin, to know these things in order to paskin about them. Davka, it's only if you're interested in tumah. That's what the Isser is. And that's why the pasuk says, ani Hashem Elokeichem, in order to emphasize that you have, it's a davra master lalev. We don't really know what your reason is, so God knows what your reason is. So whenever you have an Isser, which is all dependent on your motive, so often the Torah reminds you that even if you think no one will know, you'll always be able to blame it on something else, but God is watching, and that's his warning. And you might find a similar thing in the next pasuk as well. The pasuk concludes the Aliyah, a major idea. So you have to stand up before an elderly person, and you have to honor the face of a zaken, and you should fear Hashem. So you have a mitzvah d'oraisa here to stand up for elderly people. So it's often pointed out that it's a common complaint nowadays that you have a wedding, so there's people are walking down to the chuppah, the whole family's walking down to the chuppah, so people stand up for the chassan, they stand up for the kala. And it's the whole discussion whether or not that's really an obligation, where that comes from, where is that idea based on. But then the grandparents come down and nobody stands up for them. But that's a fair pasuk in Torah, that the Nei Seim V'takum, so if the grandparents, you for sure have to stand up for the Chasim Kal, it's not so pashut that there's an issue to stand up.
Hi. What if someone is in the middle of learning a Navin?
So that's also a whole discussion in the Kabbalah Talmud Chachamim. There's a chidah about this. So they derive it from the chidah derives, I think, from Avraham Avinu, that he interrupted his engagement with the Kaddish Baruch Hu in the beginning of Parshas Vayera. So he was makabel his orchim. So then the Gemara says, "Kedol hachnasas orchim yosim akbalos pnei shchina." So the chidah writes that's a raya, that a person should stand up for a Talmud Chacham, should stand up for others when he's in the middle of learning. Rav Shechter has a whole discussion with Pnei Harav that that's the makar for interrupting a little Kriya Shema in order to greet somebody in Mishnayos in the beginning of the second parak of Brachos.
You're just standing up for if an old person comes in. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily you're greeting them or being hospitable to them.
So halavai, we should be on the Madrega that our learning should be intense enough that even to get up for a second is recognized as a interruption. But even if it is, then it might still be justified.
If you're like in like a real shul setting where you have people walking in every 2 minutes for half an hour.
Yeah, so the question about how many people are walking in the night, you don't have to stand up for everybody. You stand up for elderly people and Talmid Chachamim.
So one can cover.
Yeah, no, so then you're at once, yeah, but if you come in later, so then you can stand up again.
Hi. I don't remember exactly the problem, but is there a darza pene, like you should turn
yes.
up your face and not that you actually have to stand up?
Well, v'hadarta means that you should show him honor. So you show him honor by stand. Doesn't mean standing up fully necessarily. Could mean just half standing, something like that. The Gemara talks about, but that's what the hiddur seems to be. The Zohar has an interesting spin on this, that it's also should be viewed homiletically, that takum, one should get up and do tshuva b'pnei seva before one gets old, like the Rambam writes. That a person who is elderly and doesn't have the same kochus, so he does tshuva then, it's not so impressive. But a person is young, and he could be doing all the same averis that he wants to do, and he still doesn't do it, so then that's considered tshuva gemura. A person is too old to do the averis anymore, so it's not as impressive. So the Zohar says, mipnei seva, before you reach that age, takum, you should get up into tshuva, so that your tshuva is going to be more meaningful. But we're going to run out of time in a second, so there's a wish. So just to mention that the Oznayim L'Torah has a comment on this pasuk. So it comes out from the Gemara that so the next pasuk, next part of the pasuk is a zaken, that refers to a Talmud Chacham, as we'll talk about in a second. So Seva doesn't have to necessarily be a Talmud Chacham. A person is not such an accomplished person, but he's old, so then we stand up for him. So why should that be? Why does he get that? So you can say many reasons why, but just he mentions there that an idea which I've heard from Rabbi Norman Lam in a different context, that, you know, they say that in general people get older, so the tithe is decreased, they don't have the same kind of passion, they don't have the same kind of drives. But he writes here, and I heard these exact words, I think Rabbi Lamb was quoting maybe Rabbi Jung, I'm not sure, that one taiva that does not decrease as people get older is the taiva for kavod. People always want kavod, and the older they get, the more they want kavod. So therefore, as Na'am Torah suggests, in the sense of de machsoro, that the Gemara says in Ksubis, that person who has a need, even if it's not a direct financial need, and it's not a need that we relate to, but it's their emotional need, so then that becomes an obligation to supply it. So if a person is older, he has an even stronger need for kavod, so then he's going to feel more anguish if he doesn't get treated that way. So then it becomes more of an obligation to supply that for somebody. Hi.
And when a person is younger and has a stronger typhus for other things?
So if the typhus themselves are Isurim, so then that's an issue. But the point is, the De Machsara might mean not dealing with prohibited taivas, but you know, the Gemara gives examples that seem pretty far out. You know, the idea that the Gemara says a person used to have servants who walked in front of him, so now you should provide him with that. So some explain that dafka means that the Gemara is telling you that it's not only a direct financial need, but a person has an emotional need, which we would call a mishigas. But the mishigas is part of what makes him feel comfortable, so then that's also... That's a good question. So that is also interesting. So here you find a steer in the sources that the Gemara also suggests that maybe it's kedai for the zaken to not be matriach people, that he should try to sneak in the room from the back, he should try to avoid making people stand up. But then there's the medrash, the Bavim Baraba, where one of the Amoraim is told that, no, you shouldn't sneak in the back, you should make sure to go in the front, you should teach the Yiras Shemayim, you should give people the opportunity to stand up for you.
So,
right, well, it's a chazal in both ways. So the point is that it's a constant tension. That on the one hand, that if a person takes it too much to heart, so then it becomes a source of gaiva. If a person is able to not connect to that and to recognize that it's being done l'shem shemayim, so then it has the potential to potential only to be positive. It's interesting. Meshech Chachma has a comment. Let's just say it very quickly. But he talks about how, in explaining a specific prat, how nowadays, so unfortunately, people are jealous of each other. So it used to be taken as a given that Talmidei Chachamim would want each other's kavod and would not have any issue with that. But nowadays, people are jealous of each other's kavod, and there's a greater need to worry about these things, and that the people are even miskabed b'klon chavero, people even built themselves up on other people falling down. And he writes that Hashem should save us from all these things. So, you know, by Cooperman from Mechala, so he published the Meshech Chachma with the footnotes. So it was a very interesting footnote. He has a lot of footnotes all the time. So on this last line where the Meshech Chachma says, Hashem should save us from this, there's a footnote there. So you look at the bottom, what's the footnote? Amen! He says that this is something we have to worry about. Hi.
Does that apply to Kenneth Sofer?
So Kenneth Sofer from the Gemara says it's good because it drives you to learn more. But if the idea is, Miskabi B'Klon Chavero in general, is the opposite. You know, the idea that, let's say a story about Rabbi Saul Salanter, that he saw two boys fighting. Each one was arguing about which one was taller. One guy was saying, I'm taller. The other was saying, I'm taller. So then finally, one boy knocked the other one to the ground. He said, there, now I'm taller. So Rabbi Saul saw this and he said, such a foolish move. You could have just stood on a box and you'd also be taller. So the point being that if your kinna drives you to stand in a box, so to speak, so that kinna sofrim pushes you to learn more, so then okay, then it's a tar b'chachma, then it's a valuable chachma. But if the kabe b'klon chavero means that you build yourself up by knocking the other guy down, so then that's in lo chela b'lom haba, as Yerushalmi says, as the Rambam Paskins. So in any event, so the idea when it comes to Zaken, Vidarta Pnei Zaken, so the Gemara says that that's different than Seva. So Seva is the old person, and Zaken is Zeshekana Chachma, acquired wisdom. So as some of the Svarim point out, okay, you see how it works, Zekana Zaken, but that could be anything then, right? So it could be Zekana cars, right? So why, how do you know that it means Chachma? So he discusses that, he quotes from other Svarim, how could it be that apparently the assumption is that the only real kinyan in life is Chachma. right? Dabe hakobe, right? Whoever has das, that's everything, and the nothing else is a real kenyan. So why should that be? So he suggests there are a couple of reasons. One is that maybe chachma really is the essence of the person. Chachma is something that no one else can steal from you. It's not subject to being unniknid. And in that same vein, it is malavi you forever. And if this is the whole purpose of life, that you should attain chachma, so this is when we talk about a kinyan, that's what a kinyan really is. The pasuk also says here, v'yareisa milakecha, and Rashi says, sounds like he's also talking about this davar hamasal alev issue, that somebody theoretically, like the famous newspaper trick that the pasuk also talks about in the context of Hashavas Aveda. So a man is sitting on a train and a pregnant lady comes on the train, doesn't want to give up his seat, so he pretends he's reading his newspaper so that he doesn't notice her. So no one's going to look down on him for not getting up for the pregnant lady. So Rashi says, so you might think, okay, you could close your eyes and not notice the Zakein coming. So if you're Eisim Lekecha, you should fear God and know that He knows what's going on. Others understand that phrase a little bit differently, that maybe Tak, if you don't see, you're not going to be Chayiv. But if you have Yirah Shamayim, you're not looking for ways out of it. You're looking to be able to perform it. And others say that no, the whole point is this mitzvah is this is how you acquire Yirah Shamayim. You acquire Yirah Shamayim by being mechabe talmid chachamim, and that's going to happen through doing this. So therefore, if you fulfill this mitzvah, so you will have more Yirah Shamayim. That's what the pasuk says, yihei marah rabcha kamarah shamayim. And it's interesting, it's explicit. The Rambam in Hilchos Tumas Tzaras, he talks about Moshe and Miriam about Lashon Hara, and he says, you speak Lashon Hara about talmid chachamim, ultimately you'll speak Lashon Hara about God Himself. That's what the Rambam says. So too, it seems to be the same idea, that if you respect Talmid Chachamim, so then that's a way to learn how to respect God. And that's what the Pasuk is saying, and that's what the Drasher of Akiva had in the Pasuk, the Gemara Maseches Pesachim. The whole story says that that Nachman ben Msuni had a Drasher on all the S in Shabbat Torah, that every time the Torah uses the word S. S this, S that. So, F, Aleph Tav. So, Nachman ben Msuni, or Nachman Mishkamzu, it's a question in Girsa. So, he had a drasha as to what it means. And then he hit one pasuk, he couldn't figure out what it could possibly mean. The S Hashem Elokeichem Tira, that he couldn't figure out what the S could come to tell you. Apparently, his philosophy was that S is coming to include something secondary. So, when you're dealing with God, there's nothing else in the same category. So, what could it possibly mean? So, he said, forget it. My whole shita was wrong and what S means. I'm giving up the whole thing. And he says, Kishem shedachisi ala drisha, kachez kalaprisha. The same way I got tzchar for being involved in darshaning the pasuk, I'll get tzchar also for abandoning this whole thing. It doesn't work. Kachez kalaprisha. Rabbi Shua Falk had both tzchuyas, because he wrote the commentary to drisha and the prisha to the Torah, so he has both tzchuyas. But in any event, so this is what he said, that he's giving up. And then Rabbi Kiva came, he told us, what does it mean? What does it mean? Es Hashem Elokeichem Tira. It says, Es, the rabbis Talmidei Chachamim. That Es comes to teach us that you have to be Mechabei Talmidei Chachamim as well. The Kotzker Rebbe, with his characteristic cynicism, he said that Es, the rabbis Talmidei Chachamim, means to tell you that Talmidei Chachamim are also Chayiv in Yirah Shamayim. You might have thought that the Talmidei Chachamim were Pater, so Es, the rabbis Talmidei Chachamim, they're also Chayiv. But we understand it not like that. We understand it to mean that the obligation of Yirah Shamayim includes Mora Talmidei Chachamim. So Rashiv Kambi Avner of Golvat Tzchon of Bracha used to explain that here, Nachmish Gamzu was a professional Es Darshaner. That was his whole life, he darshaned Eses. And he couldn't figure this one out. And then Rabbi Kiva, he walks in and he all of a sudden figures out, without as an amateur Es Darshaner, he's able to figure out what it means. How is he so zoche? So said the Rosh Yeshivas, because he saw Rav Nachman. He saw that a Talmid Chacham is so committed to Emes, he's so devoted to truth, that if there's the slightest hint that his Shita doesn't make sense, then he's willing to give up the whole thing. He's willing to abandon his life's work and to recognize that that is not going to get the same glory, but it doesn't matter, that's the Schar of the Torah is going to be the same. So Rabbi Kiva saw that. He said, a Talmid Chacham is so committed to truth, so then they are connected to the Torah in such an absolute way, so that's Marah Shamayim as well. But the point again being that through this process of being mechaber to Talmidei Chachamim, so then one gets Yirah Shamayim, so that's what's included in this pasuk as well. And Kein Yehi Ratzon, that should be our schutz. Okay, we will stop there and we'll daven mincha. Shmuel, you're down first.